second panel today deals with domestic, after we've looked at the collapse of the European whatever system. I always remember Robert Triffin always used to talk about these non-systems, and we're now in Europe getting a non-system. What we have in the U.S. we will find out by our distinguished panel, and without further introduction, because you have all of the bios in your program, so I don't have to waste time doing this, so I will ask Seth to start out by giving his assessment of just exactly how you make sense of what's happening currently in the U.S. economy.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Randy, Dimitri, for the formal invitation. It's an honor to be here. So talking about financial policy, domestic financial policy, I wanted to take a little bit of a flexible interpretation, but hopefully it will be timely with a lot of the debates that are going on now in financial markets, in politics. I think I heard Randy in the beginning say he was going to talk a bit about the Green New Deal, and so I'm sure this will have a very small amount of overlap, but nevertheless sort of maybe prime people's appetites for it. And it's about the intersection of debt management, monetary policy, what the link is there. And I think the current debate going on now in markets, in the press, in politics about modern monetary theory, what it is, what it is not, how much of a divergence it is from standard economic theory, should force people to think a lot about the interaction between debt management and monetary policy, especially when it comes to a central bank that has used its balance sheet very aggressively as a tool for policy, has said the balance sheet was going to stay on the table as a tool for monetary policy in the future for the next downturn. And for me, it's deeply personally important because I spent 15 years of my life at the Federal Reserve in D.C. By the time I left, I was Deputy Director of Monetary Affairs and worked on all of the expansion of the balance sheet and did the first couple of rough drafts that eventually got balled up and thrown away for how to exit the balance sheet. I left and went to the Treasury Department, was Assistant Secretary for Financial Markets, and oversaw the Debt Management Office. So all of these things are sort of deeply ingrained in my psyche. I'll also make one additional comment. I will every so often allude to where there are current legal or accounting or political constraints. All of those are just a reflection of where we are now. They're not in any way immutable laws of economics or physics or anything like that. And I think part of where the current debate is talking past each other is that people are different on different layers of how much you're willing to look through current convention, current rules, current laws, all of which could clearly be changed, and they haven't always been the same way. And it's one area where I think economic historians tend to have a lot to teach current policy makers. But nevertheless, I am a big believer in institutions and rules, and so one needs to understand what the current rules are before thinking about how you'd want to change things. So just walking a little bit back in history, before the crisis, life was boring. I remember in 2002, my boss at the time came into my office and said, closed the door and said, I have an opportunity for you to excel, which is Federal Reserve speak for shift flows downhill. And it was that somebody in monetary affairs had to be responsible for the Fed's balance sheet, and at the time, precisely two people in the world cared. It was me and the accountant. An accountant across the street, the general counsel, only cared if we were late publishing it every week. And of course, that world changed in 2008. But if you think about what was going on, the Fed was, at that point, buying Treasury securities on an outright basis just about every single week, but the numbers were so small it didn't seem to matter. Some months it was nothing, and the average month it was maybe $2 billion per month. The balance sheet was increasing just at the same rate as currency, physical paper currency, was increasing. I find it interesting, and that's a wonderful historical analog. That was a point where effectively what the Federal Reserve was doing was swapping one liability of the central government, treasury debt, for another liability of the central authority, currency in circulation. And the market, the population, all private actors were perfectly happy with that exchange at current prices because no one seemed to pay any attention to it. And that's going to be the first time I mention what I think of as sort of one of the interesting philosophical nuggets to wrestle with, which is the distinction that, as far as I can tell, most intro macro textbooks make in very, very bright lines between money and debt. A little bit of a funny dichotomy from my perspective. They're both liabilities of the central authorities. They have some differences. People always say, well, yeah, but money has maturity of zero and it's perfectly liquid. I might quibble with that characterization. And moreover, there are plenty of places bond size is about constant, and they adjusted for swings in cash needs by adjusting the amount of treasury bills outstanding. In the extreme, it mattered for markets, but most of the time it didn't matter very much. So you take the late 90s and into 2001, the deficit was falling. Eventually, we got to a surplus, and eventually the treasury cut back and they canceled the 30-year bond. The market cared, and you could see pricing in the market for 30-year bonds go up relative to what would be implied from all other similar instruments. And it turns out that market pricing is still evident today. If you look at the term structure of treasury securities, there's still a hole from where Peter Fisher killed the 30-year. That's going to go away over time as things age up. But nevertheless, in terms of market pricing, supply of different maturities of debt matters. It matters because they are substitutes, but they are not perfect substitutes. And exactly how that plays out has evolved dramatically over the past several decades. No doubt will continue to. There's been this 30-plus year downward trend in nominal interest rates, especially longer-term nominal interest rates, and that got a boost during the financial crisis with the massive rush to safety for treasury securities and then the Fed's balance sheet reaction, buying lots of longer-term treasury securities, buying lots of mortgage-backed securities. But what's remarkable, to take it back to the fiscal side of things, and one place where the fiscal hawks are probably being again revealed to be a little bit too alarmist, is that interest expense as a share of GDP is actually much, much, much lower now than it was during the 1980s, despite a massive amount of extra debt outstanding. So if you think about the total interest expense as a combination of the price times the quantity, the price is so much lower that the massive increase in quantity doesn't matter if you're just calculating the interest expenses of share of GDP. But what did the Fed do? So they cut short-term interest rates all the way to zero and tried to push longer-term interest rates down further using LSAPs and large-scale asset purchases. During a different conversation, possibly over beer, I will explain why I never refer to what the Fed did as QE. I am now the last person standing, I think, and part of me died when Ben Bernanke publicly referred to what the Fed did as QE, but that ship has sailed. But the theory inside the Fed at the time was what we're going to be doing is extracting duration risk from the market by buying longer-term securities. Of course, what they were doing is they were doing an asset swap with the market. They were taking longer-term securities, liabilities of the central authority that have a long, relatively long maturity, and with it, interest rate risk, duration risk, and providing to the market relatively short-term liabilities of the central authority bank reserves. And the idea was, with the central bank keeping short-term interest rates at zero, if you can drive up the price of longer-term securities, you drive down the yield, and you create more accommodative monetary policy. So that's what went on. Now where are we? The Fed's almost done with the unwind of the balance sheet. They publicly announced that September will be the end of when total assets in the balance sheet decline. And so the natural question is, what happens next? The Fed has yet to determine, although perhaps Jim will enlighten all of us with what they're going to do with their portfolio of treasury securities in a steady state. And they've been talking about two competing hypotheses: either have their portfolio of treasury securities mirror the maturity distribution of treasuries outstanding under the belief that that would somehow be neutral to interest rates. I think those analytics are wrong, but nevertheless, it's a really good story and intuitively makes sense. Or go back to what we used to do before the crisis, which is own securities all along the curve, but overweight holdings of short-term securities. What I find particularly interesting with that is, regardless of which of the two they choose, they're going to have to start to buy more short-term securities. And presumably in size, as a quantitative example, the Federal Reserve currently owns zero treasury bills. Treasury bills are roughly 15% of treasury securities outstanding. So for the more conservative, just make your portfolio mirror the portfolio distribution of treasuries outstanding. That would imply, with roughly $2 trillion of a portfolio, buying $300 billion in treasury bills, because the Fed currently owns none. That is a big number. And the market's going to care, and the market is now starting to care. They're going to care increasingly as time goes by, and as we get more information from the Fed, it's going to matter to market pricing. What I find important to highlight is that the market tends to underappreciate that now the Treasury Department itself has a reaction function. This is slightly self-aggrandizing, so please bear with me. So I became Assistant Secretary for Financial Markets in 2014, and the one thing that I'm most proud of for that time was actually enshrining a strategy for debt issuance in the Treasury Department. Now, answer is, given the current setup that we live in, where people are paying attention to the accounting of the debt, the deficit, and interest expense, boy, we should be trying to finance the federal government, finance the deficit in a way that minimizes expected cost over time. And so what that means in practice is, if the market wants to pay you a lot more for one particular type of security than they want to pay you for a different type of security, by all means, just provide more of the one that the market puts a premium on, because you're both providing a public good and you're saving the taxpayers some money. And so as we got into 2014, 2015, Treasury bills are trading at a market premium to every other money market instrument. If you were to fit a coupon curve and extrapolate it down to zero, bills are trading at a premium to that. This was before we had money market mutual fund reform. This was before the forced clearing of derivatives, where people were demanding bills to post as collateral. So demand was high and rising. So we just increased the amount of bills outstanding by a few $100 billion and saved some money. So that's where the Treasury's mindset has evolved to. They still want to be, quote, regular and predictable and make relatively gradual moves, but nevertheless, there is a reaction function. So the Fed's going to start buying Treasuries again in the secondary market in October. At some point, that pace of purchases is going to go up probably first half of next year. But nevertheless, what they buy and where they buy is going to matter for markets, and I think people are going to start to pay even more attention again to the Fed and wondering if they're meddling in financial markets, if they're distorting market prices, which for me has always been the most interesting criticism of a central bank, because if you think of monetary policy as raising and lowering short-term interest rates, by definition, it has always been distorting market prices by setting another level that you think is appropriate. But I'll leave that as an aside for now. So what could happen? Well, the Fed buys a lot of short-term debt, and short-term debt, as a result of market desires, market demand, goes up a lot in price on a relative basis. Treasury could easily adjust to in that direction. And so you might get, just out of two agents acting according to their own objective, something that looks like coordination, even though in practice it's not. I think one question that comes up a lot is, why would the Fed buy a lot of short-term debt? One of the arguments that gets made is, remember what they were doing for the asset purchases, swapping with the market, taking away from the market longer term, that giving the market short-term securities, a version of that we did in explicitly was called at the time the maturity extension program, or the so-called Operation Twist. So there is precedent for it. Moreover, there is political pressure. The Fed is not a political institution, but nevertheless it is a creature of the Congress. It is accountable to the public and to the Congress. And a lot of people in Congress got really, really angry about the size of the Fed's balance sheet. So the maturity extension program was convenient because in face value terms, the balance sheet didn't change in size, and yet the same duration extraction was able to happen. And so maybe you want to set yourself up to be able to do that again the next time, heaven forbid, we have a recession. And as long as I'm not required to specify a specific time horizon, I'll forecast that we're going to have a recession. But the counter-argument that has been made, and most forcefully by Jim's colleague Charlie Evans, is that if the Fed, in fact, has a portfolio that has a shorter maturity, then we might be affecting where our star is, in some sense pulling down the neutral rate. And the idea is, if the only way to get to a shorter maturity portfolio is by essentially forcing the market to hold more longer-term securities, then you're going to steepen the yield curve, and for any given setting at a short-term rate, financial conditions are tighter. I don't believe that conclusion is at all obvious, and this is going to be another way to, A, maybe take a small step back towards some of the MMT discussion, but by no means all of it. And moreover, it sort of points out that current convention is not in any way etched in stone. So what is happening now? The Fed has a bunch of securities on its balance sheet in September. That's going to be at no more decline. So every Treasury security that they own will get reinvested. And by law, currently, the Federal Reserve can't buy at auction from the Treasury, but they can take maturing securities and roll them over, reinvest them in whatever securities are being auctioned on the same day. And that's exactly what's been happening at the convention now, is that you just do it on a pro rata basis. Well, the funny thing is, right now, given response from Washington is, no, that's awful. If you cross that Rubicon, if there's any coordination between the Fed and the Treasury Department, you're going to have runaway rampant inflation probably the next day. Might not be bad to actually hit 2% at some point. But in addition to that, cats will start to sleep with dogs, people will compose atonal music, and the world will stop spinning on its axis. I think there is a philosophical debate about what should be the interaction between a monetary authority, the monetary policy, and debt issuance. Should it be separated? Does it matter? I think it does matter. And I think given current legal and accounting frameworks and public perceptions, it's interesting and useful to keep things separate. But that doesn't mean you should do this completely blindly. And so my approach to all of this is to say, boy, shouldn't we just have clear objectives for each institution? And the Fed has clear objectives, stable prices as defined by them as 2% inflation and full employment or maximum sustainable employment over time. The Treasury Department now has a pretty clear objective, minimize the cost of financing the deficit, at least an expected value, maybe subject to one or two constraints for the public good. But once you get to that point, I think you've got a fair amount of flexibility. So that proposal I had of the Treasury rolling over the Fed just into twos is a clear way that it doesn't do anything whatsoever to affect the Treasury Department's objectives. So if the Fed owns 2 years or the Fed owns 30 years, sure, on average, the 30-year pays a higher yield. But do you know what the Fed does with all of its net earnings? It gives it back to the Treasury Department. So either the Treasury pays the Fed a little bit less, and then the Fed gives the Treasury a little bit less because they have short-term debt, or the Treasury pays the Fed a little bit more because they've got longer-term debt, and then the Fed pays the Treasury a little bit more. That part doesn't matter at all. It's only what the market price is for the option that affects what the Treasury's payments are. So I think in that sense, with clearly defined objectives for each institution, you can sort of come to these better outcomes without having to worry about the boogeyman of things going away. And then the Fed be free in the next downturn, heaven forbid, to do the same sort of maturity extension program, because as much of a, in my view, intellectual fallacy it was last time and will be in the future, the Congress does in fact care about the size of the Fed's balance sheet. We had lots of debates in 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13 about, you know, how big can the Fed's balance sheet get? Aren't there costs to expanding the balance sheet? I always thought that was a bunch of booty, which is a technical term. But nevertheless, the world that I would like to live in is not necessarily the world that we live in. And if there is a political reality we're not respected, it's not going to change meaningfully the outcome for the Fed. But then it forces you to get back to this question, what is the Fed doing? They're changing the relative prices of different assets. Are they creating money? Are they printing money by doing asset purchases but not creating money if they sell short-term treasury debt versus buying longer-term treasury debt? I think that kind of distinction borders on the meaningless and really starts to money the issues. And I will end with the following thought, which is, again, delving further into the philosophical, which is, if we think about that dichotomy that every money and banking textbook talks about, that every intro, that I know of, every intro macro textbook talks about, which is the stark, sharp distinction between bonds and money, I find myself asking, well, is there really that much of a distinction? And people talk about, well, some treasury bills, because they're shorter maturity, are a lot more like money. So short-term debt is closer to money than longer-term debt. So then you start thinking, is that really true? And what maturity does money have? And so for those of you who spent time thinking about other systems or any economic history, you'll recall that England had, until very recently, a perpetual type of debt called a console, right? No maturity, infinite maturity. So as far away as you can possibly get from money, right? Infinite maturity. Now imagine it wasn't a coupon security that paid regular interest,
practically unknown to the U.S. taxpayer, who will ultimately once again be called upon, whether they'll do it or not, I do not know, to pay the tab. The Institute for New Economic Thinking funded a paper I wrote, presented on June 19, 2018. It's got a very long title. It's Too Big to Fail Banks Regulatory Alchemy, Converting an Obscure Agency Footnote into an At-Will Nullification of Dodd-Frank's Regulation of the Financial Swaps Market. I have a one-sheet piece of paper that has the cite to the paper on SSRN. The presentation was done with Paul Volcker and Tom Honig, who supported my thesis. I have the presentation, a blog. There was an interview done by the director of INET after the presentation was made. And also, I have all the media that appeared surrounding the presentation from the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, what have you. Essentially, the point, and it's a long paper, and as I will modestly say, a very good introduction and summary that walks you through it. These other materials will help as well. But the starting point for the paper is that, and I have 300 footnotes to support this, that most serious analyses of the meltdown point to its cause to unregulated financial derivatives. Most the spark came from naked credit default swaps, which were famously written about by Michael Lewis in The Big Short, in the movie The Big Short, where people developed the idea of betting that mortgages would default even though they didn't own the mortgages. It was like going to a football game and betting on who was going to win. The Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, after the crisis, figured out that some mortgages were bet on 9 times to fail. So it wasn't just the default on the mortgage itself. It's what somebody had to pay, and if you created the big short bet, you got full payment of the mortgage, even though you didn't own it. Now, that's a financial swap. The inability to pay off those obligations, AIG being the prime example, had that allowed to rip through the economy, there would have been a massive systemic break. Messrs. Bernanke and Paulson clearly saw, Bernanke famously, having written about the Great Depression, saw this as the beginning of what would have been something like the Second Great Depression. As it was, we had the first great recession, which was bad enough as it was. The reason for this is that because of the something called the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which was introduced in the morning and passed in the afternoon of December 15th, 2000, swaps were certainly, for certain, completely deregulated at the federal level, almost all state level, including common law doctrines of fraud and lack of consideration were written out of by federal statute. So going into the 2008 crisis, these swaps were not regulated. There was no capital. There was no collateral. There was no transparency. Certainly, the federal government had no idea what was going out there in the building up of these naked credit default swaps. It came as a surprise on September 16, 2008, and one of the responses was TARP, but more importantly, I don't know what the correct word to use is. I use quantitative easing, but I stand to be corrected, was put into place. Money was thrown at the problem. I don't second-guess that at all, but the reason money was thrown at the problem, nobody knew what the full scope of the problem was, because there was no recordation of the number of swaps that were collapsing. And Lehman shows us if one line of swaps collapses and counterparties can't make good, they can't make good on interest rate swaps, currency swaps, energy swaps, the whole market disappears. Dodd-Frank comes to the rescue. Excuse me, I'm just going to get drink of water. 7 of Dodd-Frank, not as elegant as I would have liked, but I give it a B+, said, okay, if there's going to be a swaps market, it's got to be transparent. When swaps are recorded, they have to be put in a depository so the regulators know what they are. Dealers in swaps have to have capital. They had no capital prior to 2008. They have to post collateral or margin. Wasn't done prior to 2008. They have to be cleared. I would say it's not an absolute rule, but 90% of swaps are cleared under Dodd-Frank. And if they're cleared, they have to be exchange traded, which becomes important because prior to that, you had bilateral contractual swaps with big banks, and there was no such thing as terminating the swap. If the swap turned against you, and many, many did, you had a termination penalty of accelerated payments of your obligation over 30 years of the swap contract and liquidated damages. Now, with exchange trading, you can just, if you don't like what you're doing, you can trade out of the swap. You couldn't do that before. So this is all wonderful stuff. Hurrah, hurrah. This Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which was principally in charge of implementing this, over a three-year period, put 50 rules in place. By the way, clever provision in the statute in Dodd-Frank put in by the banks was that no statutory provision applies to the rule that must be promulgated goes into effect. And it took 3 years to get these rules into effect. Last issue, what happens if a swap is traded abroad, outside the sovereign United States? There was a provision in Dodd-Frank that said if the swap can, if the failure, default on the swaps being traded can lead to an adverse effect on the financial economy of the United States, Dodd-Frank applies wherever the swap is put into place. If an extraterritorial transaction is an attempt to evade Dodd-Frank, Dodd-Frank applies. Now, I want to make clear my talk here today is about four big, too big to fail banks, Citi, Goldman, Bank of America, and J.P. Morgan Chase. They have, if you figure the swap market conventionally calculated, they have 90% of the swap market. They are systemically important. They were bailed out. They're in better shape now than they were before the meltdown. You're not, but they are. And they were rescued by the U.S. taxpayer. Now, how much that rescue is, you can find any figure. My good friend Dennis Keller just put out a report that it was a $29 trillion rescue. There's a lot of debate about that. Let's just say a lot of taxpayer money was put on the table to rescue these banks. The last thing the CFTC did was, and their theory was, we can't tell you what extraterritorial impact it will have until we know what the regulations are. And they promulgated on July 13th, 2013, an 80-page, triple-column, single-space guidance on the extraterritorial application of swaps. The only thing that the two big-to-fail banks and market reformers like Better Markets and Americans for Financial Reform agree on was that this guidance was incomprehensible. Now, that didn't bother the International Swaps Derivatives Association because in August 2013, they sent a letter to their swaps dealer members, and it said, footnote 563 out of 660 footnotes, says if a foreign subsidiary of a U.S. swaps dealer is guaranteed, Dodd-Frank applies. Now, a foreign subsidiary. Now, that was not a remarkable statement because under the ISDA template for executing a swap, which if you're executing a swap, you have to use the ISDA template. The ISDA template contemplates that all foreign subsidiaries of U.S. swaps dealers will be guaranteed by the parent, that is to say, the subsidiary subsidiaries entering into agreements with third parties, the third party can rest assured that, in this case, the U.S. Bank Holding Company will guarantee the obligations of the subsidiary. That was the way life was since 1992. Every foreign subsidiary of a U.S. bank holding company swaps dealer was guaranteed. In August 2013, ISDA sent out a letter and said, we guarantee all your foreign subsidiaries, and then you will not be covered by Dodd-Frank. It's the obverse of the statement that a guarantee subsidiary is covered by Dodd-Frank. A de-guaranteed foreign subsidiary is not. And it took the CFTC about 6 months to find out this was happening, because suddenly the U.S. swaps market declined, and nobody knew why was it declining. And slowly but surely they figured out, and somebody let the cat out of the bag, a bank employee told the CFTC regulator, oh, you should see this wonderful letter we crafted and the new clauses we have in our agreements. It took the CFTC, I can't go through all the details, but that was May of 2014 when it was discovered. In June 2016, the CFTC issues a proposed rule that says, de-guarantee. It makes no difference if the subsidiary is on the books of the holding company, Dodd-Frank applies. Quickly, the CFTC also discovered this happenstance. The banks were arranging, negotiating, and executing the swaps on Wall Street. And then, after the swap was completed, sending it off to a de-guaranteed foreign subsidiary, taking the position Dodd-Frank doesn't apply. Proposed rule comes out in May of 2016. Everybody thinking that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. Hillary Clinton will be president and will finalize this. That rule has never been looked at again. We still live under a situation where if the swap goes off to the foreign subsidiary of one of the four big U.S. bank holding companies, it is not regulated by Dodd-Frank. Now, the banks will say, oh, but we're in the European Union. Well, we heard in the first panel how the European Union is doing. By the way, the European Union, if you talk to bankers, it's like nirvana, wonderful regulation. The U.S. should only adopt those policies. So we have uniform worldwide regulation. There are even more nightmares about the impact the European Union has had on swaps regulation. So you didn't know this. Virtually nobody knows this. Today, for all practical matters, Dodd-Frank's regulation of swaps is dead in the water. Now, that doesn't mean every swap will fall outside of Dodd-Frank, because some come voluntarily within the ambit. But if one of the four big bank holding companies does not want to follow Dodd-Frank, they at will can assign the swap to a foreign subsidiary and it will be unregulated. Chris Dodd in January, I think it was 2011, after he sat down, gave a speech and said, you know, whenever I came to the floor to talk about Dodd-Frank and swaps, people would not come to me and ask me these very technical questions about how these regulations work. They would say, Chris, just tell us you know what you're doing. And that was evidence of the fact that nobody in the Senate knew what they were doing. My experience is very few people know what swaps regulation is. It is completely unlike the securities laws, which have grown up since the New Deal. And people have been on both sides of the need to enforce. The people who understand swaps regulation are the banks, and they have an objective to escape regulation. I would finally say Donald Trump, when he came into office, said, we're going to get rid of Dodd-Frank. We're going to unravel Dodd-Frank. There has been no serious proposal to unravel the Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank swaps regulation. They don't need to unravel. By the way, this all happened under Obama, not under Trump. Not only do the banks not need to unravel it, but if they come forward with some proposal, there is bipartisan interest in reasserting Glass-Steagall. Now, is that interest rational or fully understood? No, it sounds good. We're going to separate the banks from the investment side and the commercial depository side. A lot of Republicans, they don't know what they're saying, but want to reinstate Glass-Steagall. If a legislative proposal comes forward to legislatively accomplish what's been accomplished through sleight of hand, the banks run that risk. Interestingly enough, many of you may have seen last spring, Bill S-2155 passed the Senate with 17 Democrats supporting the Republicans. It broke a filibuster, and it was originally designed to reduce capital for community banks, banks with $10 billion in assets or less. It was expanded, giving the Fed the discretion to reduce capital requirements for mid-sized banks, $250 billion or less. As it was going through, Citi and J.P. Morgan Chase said, why not us? Why shouldn't we get this capital relief? That provoked an unmitigated furor. The people, when they understand what's happening, do not want to see these banks being deregulated. In fact, at the Citi and J.P. Morgan shareholders meetings, shareholders were getting up and saying, what are you doing? You're putting the bank at our share. Well, in 2008, the shareholders didn't take a haircut, but they may take a haircut the next time. So they don't want this to happen. 1 week after J.P. Morgan Chase said, we want this too, Jamie Dimon got up and gave a speech at Howard University and said, let me be clear, S-2155 is not for us. We're too big. It's for smaller banks. By the way, you're seeing now the Fed had the discretion to relieve capital requirements for mid-sized banks. They've taken that discretion. There's been a lot in the papers. Whoa, we're going down the deregulatory road again. But if an issue is presented squarely so that the American people understand it, that is to say, Goldman, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Citi are going to be out of regulation of the very instruments that caused the 2008 meltdown, that is not going to go anywhere. The problem is getting people to understand the problem enough to be able to present it in that way. Thank you.
Okay. This is very preliminary work. I was hoping that we would have more done. Yeva got called away to Armenia. And so major parts of this are not completed yet. What we're doing is presenting a different way to go about costing the Green New Deal. I'm sure that you're going to say this is very obvious. The question is, why isn't anyone doing it this way? It turns out to be a little more difficult than I originally thought, and we're actually going to have to use some of the same data sources that Dan is using, so there is a pretty close relationship. So, calling it the Big Meow, the older people here will remember the reference, Jimmy Carter's meow, which is a baby little kitten meow. We had inflation. Oh my goodness, moral equivalent of war. This one is the moral equivalent of war, and so that's the way we're looking at it. What matters is the resource availability. Ideally, we would have very fine measures of the resources that will be required to implement the Green New Deal. But for some of these areas, it's going to be very difficult to get those. So we're going to fall back on largely labor resources, which are an important part of the resources we're going to need. I'll briefly talk about Keynes' approach to how do we pay for the war, and that's relevant because this is like a mobilization of the entire economy and society to tackle the problems that the Green New Deal will be attacking. Briefly present some wild estimates of other people on the costs. sources of costs, very rough measures, and talk about how we might deal with any inflationary pressures if they might arise. Everyone is assuming that there will be massive inflation due to the spending on the Green New Deal. We think that if you look at the resources that will be required, it's unlikely that the inflation pressures are going to be very big. But if they do arise, we need to be able to tackle those. So, as I said, we're looking at this as the biggest challenge that the United States and the world economies have faced since the 1930s and World War II. Last time around, we met the challenge. We did it. And so I think that we can learn from that. And if we could meet that challenge in the past, we should be able to meet this challenge today. There will be short-term sacrifices that have to be made, but I think that the long-term gains far outweigh the short-term sacrifices, just as they did with our previous challenge. We came out of World War II with very large long-term gains. So the gains that we would achieve if we met the challenge would be environmental sustainability, greater equality, shared prosperity, jobs for all, healthcare for all, child care for all, and the forever wars. These are the main components of the Green New Deal I'm going to emphasize. I know this is not a final product. Lots of things are being thrown out and included in the Green New Deal. These are the ones that we're going to be looking at. I just got this Bernie's how we're going to pay for things. This is precisely what you don't want to do. I love Bernie, but this is the wrong way to go about it. We're going to rebuild America by taxing offshore income. That doesn't help at all. It doesn't matter how much revenue you raise. It doesn't help at all. Remaking America, okay? So let's look at Keynes. How do we pay for the war? During war, production and incomes increase, but the output available for consumption does not. In fact, it probably is going to shrink. So we move from a time of plenty in the sense of, hey, we've got insufficient aggregate demand, resources are plentiful, to a time of scarcity, income and propensity to consume only slightly determine consumption in a time of scarcity. Planning for war is not a financial but a real resource problem. So first, we have to determine how much output can we produce, including mobilization of underutilized resources plus what we can import. Now, I'll argue that we can't use that this time around. Back then we could, okay, because everyone faces the same challenge that we face. How much of that is needed for the war effort, how much is left for private consumption, and therefore how much demand has to be withdrawn from the economy. How do you reduce demand, according to Keynes? Taxes, rations, voluntary savings, and or deferred pay. And he goes through the pros and cons of each one of these taxes and rations. The problem is they've got to be directed to the right place. Taxing offshore income is not going to solve our inflation problem. Okay? It has no impact. So we've got to direct to reduce the use of resources that we need for the Green New Deal effort. That's where the taxes have to go. We might as well be taxing Martians, I say, as the Bernie's list. The financial transactions tax. How does that reduce inflation? Okay, tax the Martians instead. If it makes you happy to tax somebody, tax Martians. Voluntary savings. Keynes argued that that's probably going to be inadequate. It requires collective, not individual action. If workers choose to spend more than what's available for consumption, so they're not saving enough, then prices go up. There's going to be a wage-price spiral, so I'll just cut to the chase. So it's likely that that is not going to be sufficient to fight the inflation. Deferred pay, this is actually the preferred method, and this will be our preferred method also. Workers earn deferred income, which can be used to buy bonds. Prices won't rise, and the ownership of financial assets becomes more equalized. Workers increase their consumption after the war, which will help solve the problem of the slump that is almost certain to follow the war. Same thing with the Green New Deal. Some aspects of the Green New Deal are going to be permanent, but some are, you know, one-time, 10-year, one-decade investments we have to make. And so we need to deal with the slump that will follow this, and
this is one way to do it, deferred earnings. So MMT approach, been mentioned a couple times. Estimates of the Green New Deal have been focusing on the financial costs of the various programs and wondering how we're going to be able to afford to pay these things. MMT approach, we don't need to tax the rich, we don't have to bankrupt the kids, we don't have to borrow from China, we don't have to get the Fed to print more money. Okay, none of those are necessary. A country with a sovereign currency has the financial wherewithal to afford whatever we know how to do. If we know how to reverse climate change, we can finance it. In fact, Foster may not be a name that many of you know, one of the greatest American institutionalists. Whatever is technologically possible is financially feasible. If the financial system isn't capable of financing the Green New Deal, we need to change the financial system. If you think about what we did with the housing markets, that's precisely what we did with the New Deal. We didn't have a financial system that would allow people to buy houses. We knew how to build houses, so we had to create a financial system that would finance home purchases, and we did that with a self-amortizing mortgage. So we can find a way to finance the Green New Deal if our current financial system can't do it. And I think we can. We already have a financial system that can finance this. Assessing the economic feasibility of the Green New Deal must be focused on technological know-how and not on the dollar costs. The important question is, how can we mobilize underutilized resources and shift resources from destructive uses to constructive uses? And if necessary, how do we reduce private resource use to release resources to be used in the Green New Deal? So we provide a preliminary assessment to determine whether natural resources are going to be sufficient to phase in the Green New Deal. Now, resources and outputs are heterogeneous, and this is what makes the problem complex. So conceptually, you can see what we're trying to do. It's very difficult to do because the outputs and the inputs are very heterogeneous. So for the purposes of today, I'm going to be using dollars. That's not a very good way to measure your resources. Okay. Eventually, we will be able to do it in terms of labor. Still not ideal. Components of the Green New Deal, greening up the economy, so in the fossil fuel use, alternative energy is a new power grid to handle shifting much of this to electricity. Transportation, greening of transportation, we need a new transportation system, and we need a public infrastructure that goes beyond that, because we have to change people's behavior. We have to provide better recreational outlets than going to the shopping mall. Okay. Medicare for all, job guarantee. Job guarantee itself will provide a lot of the resources used for the greening programs, but also we're going to provide care services for the environment, for the community, and for people. Pavlina talked about that at the conference last year. We're going to end the forever wars, reduce inequality, tax the rich, raise income at the bottom, student debt relief, free public education, and universal child care. So these are the components that we're going to be trying to cost out. This is probably the most cited projection of the costs. They come to $93 trillion. And then they very helpfully tell each household how much their taxes have to go up to pay for this. Okay. This is, what is this? Absolutely useless for figuring out whether we can afford the Green New Deal, whether we will be able to save the planet. It's by design just supposed to scare you so that you won't even try. It's better just to go extinct because it's just so costly to try to ensure human survival. That's what they're trying to do. Others have been providing much more reasonable estimates, but they're still all about the financial costs. The Medicare for All, so the previous slide has that at $36 trillion. Bauhaus, I don't know if you know who he is. I know who he is. His whole career has been spent trying to get rid of Social Security. And so, obviously, he wants to stop Medicare for All, too. So he comes up with pretty high ones, but even he has to admit on some assumptions, you actually end up with savings if you shift off the current system to Medicare.
system has savings of 2.2 to 3.2% of GDP annually, we'd still be an outlier, way beyond what any other rich developed country spends on healthcare. But that's a pretty big savings. Okay? Job guarantee, they put it at up to $45 trillion to implement a job guarantee program. Darity has about $540 billion in their report. Booker has proposed a job guarantee, $543 billion. Last year, we presented our report. It comes in at about $560 billion. The budgetary impact is about $400 billion. So that's about 2% of GDP, and we're going to run with that number. Okay, so it's about 2% of GDP. The greening estimates over a 10-year period, okay, they've got it at up to 6% of GDP. There is a great variability in what is included in the greening, and that it accounts for the wide range of the estimates. We prefer the Jacobson one, which is one of the high ones, because they go to 100% renewable and no nuclear power, no natural gas. So we are going to go with a higher estimate than many others. Medicare for All would be a significant source of savings of resources. Use will go up marginally because we're going to be including more people in the healthcare system. And people don't have to avoid care because they're worried that their insurer won't cover the care. So use will go up at least marginally. Perhaps about 10% is an estimate. The U.S. surprisingly doesn't use more services per capita. Many people think that that's why we devote about twice as much of our GDP. Actually, Americans don't get more services. And except for obesity, our health outcomes are not much different than European health outcomes. So more people will be covered, but the costs are going to decline from 18% of GDP. The main differences, if you compare us to the other wealthy nations, are that we have an expensive for-profit insurance as one of the main payers. The net cost of insurance is about $150 billion annually. That's the difference between the premiums you pay in and the amount that they pay out. So that's about 0.75% of GDP. Compensation of healthcare workers is a lot higher. We're about double. We pay about double what our peers pay healthcare workers. The administrative costs are very, very much higher. About 8% of total healthcare costs are administrative. A lot of that has to do with the extra billing that is required to pay through private health insurance. Depending on assumptions, Medicare for All could save 3.3%, so we're going to start with that, 3.3%. I think that's a very conservative estimate, and over time we're going to move more towards what the other peer nations do. So we'll continue to reduce our share of GDP going to healthcare. Job guarantee, it's a cost in financial terms, but it's a source of real resources for the Green New Deal. Workers will be employed for infrastructure, not huge infrastructure projects. That's not what job guarantee workers are going to do, but they can do things like retrofitting and installing things. Environmental services, tree planting, and again, the care services. The job guarantee mobilizes labor resources that are not being used in the private sector. So this is a net addition of resources that we're wasting right now. We do believe we have a very generous job guarantee program. It is $15 an hour, and there will be a few hundred thousand workers that are going to be shed by the private sector as wages are bid up to $15 an hour. But for the most part, most of the workers in this program, 15 million workers, will be people who are not currently employed. It's difficult to calculate potential supply. If we just go by the dollar figures, then that impact on the budget is about $400 billion. We assume that the value of the resources going toward the Green New Deal projects is only about 3% of GDP. Other components that we're including in the Green New Deal, student debt relief. There's a Levy report that came out last year on that, so we're using the data from there. I won't go through that. Our argument is that this is going to help people get their lives in order, start families, and get settled down earlier. So this is probably actually adding resources that are available, but we're not going to count anything from this. Free college, everyone agrees college pays for itself. So in terms of resources, whatever resources we have to devote to more classes, more professors, all that, will be more than made up for by the increased productivity of workers who have college educations. Same for public infrastructure. The IMF says that a dollar of investment gives you $3 of output. So, again, we're going to count that as zero because whatever resource we put in the infrastructure, we're going to get back. Tax the rich, well, that would free some resources, but I think it's so insignificant that we're not going to count that. So we count that as no net source of resources that are freed up because somebody doesn't buy the third yacht. Yeah, there will be some, but we're not going to count it. Universal child care, we're going to assume that that pays for itself, too, in terms of a very long-term enhancing the productivity of people who get decent child care when they're young. So, to conclude, summary of the resource costs. So here, the positive are use of resources for the Green New Deal. The negative are sources of resources that are used for the Green New Deal. So the greening projects are about 5% of GDP. The reduction of resource use in the medical care system will be 3.3%. The job guarantee is a source of resources, about 1% of GDP. Ending forever wars, it's hard to get good numbers on this. It's hard to know exactly what the spending on war is because it's included in lots of budgets that are outside the Defense Department. So we're putting a very conservative number on this at 1% of GDP. So the net resource costs are actually negative. Okay? We could be wrong. So, caveats. The released resources might not be appropriate. Okay, that's going to be a problem. We're going to stop fracking and we're going to put in solar power. Or the resources that are now fracking very well suited to installing solar power? Maybe not. So it may take resources to train or retrain workers to do the kinds of projects the Green New Deal needs. As I said, we can't rely much on imports. We are obviously doing that right now for solar power. We're going to have to start producing our own because everybody needs solar power. So we can't rely on imports for this. We might be underestimating the inflation threat, in particular, shifting healthcare to government creates large savings to employers and some savings to employees. I'll come back to that. So what happens if we reduce the resources in the healthcare system by 3%? Doesn't that increase consumption by 3%? So if we do get inflation pressure, what should we do? Let's say taxes. We need targeted taxes. So turnover taxes, offshore income taxes, corporate profit taxes, high wealth taxes, carried income taxes. Those are all the progressives' popular taxes. None of those help. Okay, so that's not, I'm not against them. Let's do it. But the purpose is not to free up resources and fight inflation. It's because rich people are too rich. That's the only justification for these kinds of taxes. Taxes on consumption are what you need. Taxes on wages would be effective, but they're politically unpopular and they're unfair because wages have been stagnant and, as Dan shows, actually declining for a very large part of the population. So I don't think that we should tax wages for this. Shifting healthcare to the government. So people argue that since employers pay most of that, eliminating the private insurance is going to lead to a huge windfall for employers. So, of course, you're going to raise wages. Well, those aren't the kinds of employers that I see are
it's going to be the windfall profits that go to the employers. So there is probably some justification in taxing that. So this is the last slide. I think that Keynes's proposal to defer compensation is the best thing to do. And what is the best way to defer the compensation? So one way would be every individual worker holds the bonds, which was his recommendation. I think that what we need is a social approach to deal with an aging society in which Social Security is not adequate for the majority of people who are retiring. So we need to guarantee a decent retirement for all, de-link the benefits from the earnings over the qualified periods, or at least boost the benefits in a highly progressive manner, because the problem really is people with low earnings do not get enough Social Security to live on. So Bernie has proposed, it was in the slide, 6.2% new payroll tax on employers and 2.2% on employees to pay for it. So I'm not advocating it to pay for it. Okay, this is not to pay for the program, but let's go ahead and put the tax on, okay, in order to reduce demand. The one on the employers is just to take back those windfall profits that they're going to get, and then on employees to reduce their demand a bit, but with the promise of much better retirements for them when they retire. So it's not to pay for any of the programs. It's deferred compensation. It's Keynes' sinking